The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome to Capital Thinking. April is upon us. I hope everyone has had their great Passover or Easter. Congress is out for a second week. The president is in South America, and we're going to cover two critical topics that we continue to focus on here on Capital Thinking today. That's going to be health care reform in the United States Congress and the Obama administration, and then also the seismic reshaping of the financial services world. That'll be the focus of our guests today. Our first guest today is John Jonas. He is the head and founder of the Healthcare Practice Group at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., and one of the most accomplished and recognized healthcare policy experts here in Washington. John, welcome back to the show. We are delighted to have you on Capital Thinking.
Great, Kevin. Thanks. It's great to be back on your show.
Listen, let's start. Congress is out of town, but I suspect the wheels are still turning at the staff level there. Tell us a little bit about the state of play on healthcare reform and what's going to happen when they get back in town next week.
Yes, well, as you can imagine, kind of reforming the healthcare system in the United States is a massive, massive undertaking. And the Congress and the Obama administration have both set out very, and I think probably almost slightly unrealistic timetables for themselves in terms of rolling out healthcare reform proposals over the next couple of months. But the staffs, of course, have to try and meet those deadlines, so they are very, very hard at work over the congressional recess to try and put together the building blocks. I think there are a couple of really sort of interesting things to observe about the process to date. One thing I think you have to sort of keep in mind is the old separation of powers and the difference between the House and the Senate. We really have the various bodies having relatively different approaches to healthcare reform and also coming at it in slightly different directions. So the House is busily putting together a House of Representatives, largely Democratic, healthcare reform proposal. They tend to be initially very focused on this question of a federal plan option. Namely, should there be a sort of default federal insurance plan that everyone can get who otherwise is unable to get insurance, a plan that's probably subsidized, the purchase of which is probably subsidized for those who need subsidy. And the plan sort of stands kind of a benchmark for by which private plans are measured against. That's a little bit of the focus in the House. Very big issue. Seems to be some consensus among Democrats in the House around that issue. Maybe a tougher sell in the Senate, but that's, I think, a lot of the focus of the House legislation to date. In the Senate, interestingly enough, where there's much, much less consensus about this idea of a federal plan and what exactly the federal role should be in directing insurance, they're really starting with payment reform and changing the payment methodology, and many of that centers around the Medicare program. So the Senate Finance Committee is getting ready to have a stakeholder meeting where they're going to talk about reforming the payment methodologies for providing healthcare services, which is said quite different than figuring out what the insurance plan should look like. And the administration is still in the process of kind of putting its key people in place. They've got Nancy Ann Min DePearl, who's quarterbacking the health reform effort, and her job to date seems to be very much attempting to see if there's some broad consensuses among the various stakeholders, and they don't seem to be looking to develop a plan that they are going to market directly. They look really to be helping to push forward both the House and the Senate process towards some kind of proposal that can win votes in both bodies. Sorry for the long answer. It's just a complicated state of play at the moment.
Just to make sure I understand, so the Obama administration is long on vision and principles but short on details because they want to have the flexibility legislatively to work with both chambers of Congress to get across the finish line on this, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct. A fair number of people are sort of working backwards from flaws that people perceive to have existed during the Clinton health reform effort. You know, everybody rewrites and looks at history in their own way, but one of the lessons learned apparently was that the White House-directed operation of the Clinton era in the 90s failed because too much of the design work was done at the White House, and then it was given to the Congress and sort of told, here, you guys pass it, good luck, and that obviously that process failed. And so I think it's here is to let Congress engage in a lot of the construction process without too much of a White House kind of telling them it's got to be this model, it's got to be that model, here are the five or six things that we have to have in there. Clearly, Obama has stated his broad principles and outline for health care reform, and there's a lot of material from the campaign, and the Obama administration's been pretty good to date with following through on its kind of campaign principles and promises, so it's not like there isn't material there, but it doesn't look like they're trying to develop a specific prescriptive healthcare reform model that they want to sell to either the House or Senate.
Now, John, I know especially in the Senate there's more chance this will be a bipartisan process, but you mentioned the Clinton effort and some of the reasons it failed. It seems like this time around you have a lot more of the stakeholders, the insurance companies, the hospitals, the physician world, the medical providers, all at the table saying, yes, something must be done. But then you go back to what you said was sort of the central issue in the House bill, this public option, if you will, this public insurance option. Is that enough to drive some of those stakeholders like the insurance companies away at the end of the day?
Well, there are some things that are very different from between now and the 1990s when we did last in healthcare reform, and there are some things that are very much the same. I think what's different is that the financial burden of healthcare on small businesses and on large business, you see what a big issue it is in the auto restructuring bailout issue, has really incentivized a lot of players to be much more interested in kind of comprehensive healthcare reform than they were in the past. And I think the public, given not only their economic distress that we're experiencing, but the ever-increasing costs of insurance premiums, I think the public has moved much more in the direction of healthcare reform. So I think there is a broader political base of support for healthcare reform than there was a decade ago. And I think you're seeing that by having a lot more of the players at the table. What is the same as it was a decade ago, which is you have to do healthcare reform, you have to rearrange an awful lot of economic relationships. There's certain ways that doctors are paid. There's certain ways hospitals are compensated, nursing homes, rehab providers. And to really bring healthcare reform into being, you have to rearrange and modify and change a lot of those relationships. And as we know, change is hard. It doesn't come easy. It certainly doesn't come easy to such a big sector as healthcare. And so as we go through the healthcare reform process, as we move from concept to actual detailed plan and methods of actually implementing these concepts, it's going to get tougher and tougher. And so folks are very much on board for the concepts. Folks are very much on board for the mission, but not enough of the details are out there and not enough of the pain is out there. All these processes have their level of pain to them to really assess how much wind there really is to the sails here and how much change people are willing to live with at the end of the day.
You mentioned the ambitious timeline. I've got about 60 seconds left here, John. What is your sense of what will realistically happen, say, by the end of July when Congress takes its month-long recess for August? Where do you think we'll be at that point?
I think by then we'll have the broad outlines of the direction in which probably both the House and Senate want to go. I think by then they will have filled in a couple of these key pieces that for us are still unknown. For example, what is the method for delivering expanded coverage, and what's the structure of it? What are some of the pay-fors? Is this a mandate on individuals? Is this a mandate on businesses? So I think by then we'll have some of the bigger sort of skeletal picture is, well, they're trying to build a building that's, 20 stories high kind of thing. But we will still, I think, be lacking on a lot of the key issues of exactly how this is going to work and what some of these details are.
We'll wrap it up there. We'll have John on some other time. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back in a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you, Ken.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORA-KID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Well, it's April 16th, and if you're like many Americans, you're waking up with a financial hangover. Yesterday was tax day, and it was probably a stark reminder for many of our listeners about how much poorer they are after they stroke that check to the federal government, how much their financial stability has decreased over the last 18 to 24 months from where we were back in the heady days of 2006 and 2007. We're going to spend the next half hour talking about some of the key issues in the financial services world, and we've got a fantastic guest with us. It's Tom Russo. Tom is one of the top financial services lawyers in the United States, former vice chairman of Lehman Brothers, where he was also the chief legal officer of that company. Before that, National Law Journal has considered him one of the most influential lawyers in the United States. He's got a fantastic resume here. I see also that Russo is an adjunct professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Business, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But, Tom, first, welcome to Capital Thinking and your maiden voyage here on the show. I know we have lots of folks who want to hear from you about what's going on, and I want to take it from a big-picture perspective and ask you to tell us a little bit about how we got to April 16, 2009, rewind on the financial services world, and how did we get where we are today?
Well, it's that's an important question, and there are probably a lot of answers to it. I think one way to look at it is the leverage that was built in the system. When you de-lever, you naturally have problems. Let me start from the beginning. If you look at the U.S. economy, which is very different than the economies in the rest of the world, you have an enormous amount of consumption. It's roughly speaking 70% of our gross national product. So much of the net worth of this country is dependent upon people spending money. So that's a very important ingredient in this. If you look at why people spend money, they spend money, one, because they earn money in income, but also because their balance sheets expand, which is the main reason why people didn't have to save in this country for a number of years. From their point of view, if you made $100 and you spent $100, whether it be in taxes or in consumer products or whatever, or a car, if your balance sheet was increasing, your wealth effect is every bit as great as if you saved some of that money and your balance sheet didn't change because the assets didn't change. But the value of assets increased dramatically, and in particular, the value of your assets increased because of the value of your home, which is a big percentage of your net worth.
Right.
So what happened, I think, is that you had created the various bubbles, and when you had the bursting of the bubble, and in particular with housing prices, when the dramatic decrease in housing prices, people began to see that they needed to save and spend less. And just as important, as all of this was happening, unemployment reached its 8.5% now and heading north. And so people were very nervous about whether they would have a job. So they began to spend less, and where they spent it was on things that were really not as postponable. And so you have this kind of almost a tailspin in the economy, and then that led, and that's one part of it. And the other part of it is the entire banking system, where you had the tremendous decrease in the value of assets, the, in some sense mirroring what was happening to the consumer. And the write-offs of those assets were, in the United States, astronomical. The total global write-offs in the last year and a half or 2 years is roughly $1.3 trillion. And in the United States, in I think the second quarter of 08, it was about $108 billion. The third quarter reached about $191 billion, and in the fourth quarter, about $119 billion. So you have the credit just totally drying up, and banks not wanting to lend. And so you have a problem that was totally began to compound itself, and every cylinder, whether it be consumption or lending or investing, was pretty much slowed to a snail's pace to what was absolutely necessary, and people became very protective, and that's where we are today.
Very good. I mean, you've been at sort of the center of a lot of these things in your career to understand how we got where we are, so I think it's a fascinating discussion. You know, we, Capital Thinking, focuses a lot on the intersection of government and the business community. And so, you know, the government's been engaged in a lot of different things here in the crisis. And you see yesterday with the Tea Parties and anytime you turn on the news, there are a lot of people who criticize what the government has done. And you have, I think, a very unique perspective. So I'd like you to comment a little bit about how effective you think the government's measures have been in this crisis, and what they're doing to save or to hurt the financial services industry.
Well, the government has a number of traditional tools and a number of tools that were recently created. On a monetary side, it did something that was totally predictable. It lowered interest rates, and that became very important. But it was only one element. It had a problem with it is the traditional monetary policy lowers interest rates for short-run interest rates. So what was happening is there was enormous spreads on the longer side of the long side of the curve, and assets were just not being able to be sold. So you had to do more. But that was necessary to do what they did. With respect to interest rates on the long side, they have been buying assets on the long side, and they've been creating various programs. I mean, the most obvious program was the one that they did for the troubled assets. They have, two big programs. One is the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, where they're actually buying asset-backed securities. And I think it's fair to say that, while nothing is perfect, that program, whether it's because of it or whatever reason, spreads have gone down, which means that people are able to securitize certain receivables, credit card receivables, and automotive receivables in a way that they weren't able to do before. And I think that's been very, very helpful. So you have to give the government a lot of credit. Their program with respect to just troubled assets in general, I think it's fair to say, got off to a very poor start, because originally it was going to buy assets and then it put capital into the banks. And I think on that, time will tell how that program really does work, because it's one thing to put capital in the banks, another thing to get the banks to lend. And there's a lot of debate now, and I don't know what the answer to the debate is, but it does appear that many would say that the banks are not lending, so even though they may have the money. So I think that still remains to be a problem. And finally, there's the ultimate in fiscal policy, which is really directed at the entire economy, and that was the stimulus package. And on that, I think it's fair to say that everyone agrees that you have to put a lot of money into this economy, because there's nobody else really putting money into the economy. And the government, if there was ever a time for a fiscal stimulus, it is now. And so that part is good. The part that I think has raised some questions is the amount that will actually go into the economy in this year. The Congressional Budget Office, I think, was in the one-third of the full package this year, and who knows what the real number will be, but that money needs to go in very quickly because of the lack of other people putting money in.
Now, Tom, we got about 2 minutes to the break. We're going to come back and talk some more about these big picture issues. But I know you're going to be a professor at Columbia's grad school of business, and I'd be loving to take that class and hearing your perspective. I know you're doing some different things to attack these financial market issues and educate the next generation. You want to talk about that before we go into the break?
Yeah, well, maybe we should. I'll just do it generally and then talk about it. I found often when you go through periods, and especially when you've seen it from kind of the inside, it's very helpful to write about it, talk about it, or what have you, about not the specific thing, but the general thing. And teaching at Columbia is a vehicle to at least address the some of the bigger issues that the country faces. And I'm going to do it, and I'll explain it after the break, through a series of role-playing by the students for a lot of reasons. But I want a student to understand that you have to look at all problems, not only through the eyes of the seat that you're in, but through the eyes of other people. And so we're going to have quite a lot of role-playing, which I'll explain after the break.
And is that just graduate business students you're teaching or undergrads as well?
These will be graduate students, people getting their MBAs. And so it's to me, it's the amount of work you have to put in this was far more than I would have dreamed possible, but the enjoyment out of it is enormous.
That gives you probably some new respect for back in the day when you were a student taking classes of your own.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. I still have to get my sport jacket with the patches on my the elbow. Then I'll be complete.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, thanks for joining us on Capital Thinking. Tom Russo is our guest for this segment, former vice chairman of Lehman Brothers and now a partner in the New York office of the law firm of Patton Boggs, an acknowledged expert in all that's going on in the regulatory changes for Wall Street and how it impacts Main Street. Tom, let's pick back up where we were before the break here and talk a little bit about your views about the evolution of the regulatory structure for the financial services industry. Where are we headed?
Well, I think in the past when there have been issues, you had, relatively speaking, targeted response. I don't know how targeted Sarbanes-Oxley was, but relatively speaking, targeted. I think every once in a while you will, in any area, have dramatic changes, and this is certainly the time for such a change in the financial services industry. Most of the financial services industry grew up at a time when the globalization wasn't the case. It grew up at a time when banks were banks, brokers were brokers, and commodities were pure commodities and not financial instruments. And over the years, you've sort of changed that structure within the structure. So you make exceptions, you do this, add this piece of legislation. I think now there will be a very dramatic change to a much more centralized way of doing things. And if the people responsible for those changes do the right thing, they will try to fit whatever structure, and I can go through some of the things I think will happen, into what's happened in the past, because we may not be able to predict the future, but we sure as hell could have a structure which would have addressed some of the issues we've seen in the past decade or so.
Very good. Do you think there's a danger of re-regulation going too far to the opposite extreme?
That undoubtedly will be... there will be pushes to do that. It is, in some sense, a little bit ironic because a lot of what caused the problem was, when all is said and done, leverage within the system, and the leverage within the system was, for the most part, subject already to regulation. So if the government permitted an entire industry to go 95 miles an hour, you can't expect companies who are competing against one another to go 70. So I think whatever structure there is, I think there'll be a real emphasis on prudential regulation and on leverage. And because I think ultimately, whether it be in the banking system or whether it be in with the consumer or, frankly, whether it be with the federal government itself, leverage is something which cuts both ways, profitability and write-downs. And we have to be very careful about that. So whatever structure emerges, I'm sure that capital rules and including the leverage component will be a very important aspect of those rules.
What about profitability? I mean, we saw the markets sort of be buoyed in recent days by some favorable profit reports out of Goldman and I believe Wells Fargo, if I'm not mistaken. Does the regulatory structure really have an impact on profitability for the industry?
I think it's going to have a pretty dramatic. Remember, you have to have to understand that a lot of these institutions, A, have already written down an enormous amount of their assets, so that while there undoubtedly will be more write-downs, I'd be a little surprised if they're anywhere close to the magnitude of the past. So you have that. But just as important, you have an amazingly low cost of capital. So that banks, in particular, if you went to a bank with a CD now versus 6 months ago for a CD, you're lucky to get half the interest rate. In addition, there's a lot of money from the government that is extraordinarily cheap. So that when banks who traffic in money have it in some sense very good right now, in some sense. So that I think the cheapness of money, that may come to an end, because one of the, well, first, a lot of these programs themselves will come to an end. We can't continue this forever. And number two is, I would suspect over time, with the deficit increasing the way it is, and the concern by foreign governments about dollar assets, interest rates, there will be an issue about inflation at some point. None now, but it will be there, and interest rates will go up, and that will affect profitability. But the most important thing is often profitability is a function of leverage. And to the extent that regulators rein in the leverage of these institutions, that will affect profit, because it's the amount that they could leverage above that what they're paying for that leverage really steroids with respect to profitability.
Gotcha. Boy, interesting times. You talk about the CD, and I'm thinking, who's got the cash to go in and get a CD, interest rate or no interest rate? Being lawyers, I guess I'm interested in knowing, as I read the blogs and talk to my friends in the halls of other law firms, the financial services changes are having a profound impact on the legal profession. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's going to be so many changes that people practicing in areas are just going to have to retool, if you will, because everything, I think, is going to be, not everything, but most things are going to be different, and some things dramatically different. I suspect, for example, that the whole bankruptcy regime for financial institutions is going to probably be changed to a more like a workout type thing. So I think that's going to have dramatic effects. Hedge funds, I think there's very little doubt that there's going to be a regulatory regimen for hedge funds. How far it will go is another question. But that's going to change the way people give advice to people. Private equity funds, things will be very different for them, and so that will change. I think the whole securitization process is going to change. There's probably going to be a lot more data. There's going to be a lot more disclosure. That whole area will change, so the people doing that will change. I think there will be a lot less of products that people find difficult to understand, and a lot more pure vanilla. So that's going to have some impact upon legal representation. There's going to be whole new structures in terms of warranties. The whole area of credit default swaps, I think, is going to change. You'll see it more and more as it's evolving right now on clearing and maybe even on exchanges. There will undoubtedly be a lot of talk about the SEC and CFTC and those practicing in those areas. I don't think it's necessarily going to be that one merges into the other. You could have a whole new different regiment where you have a little bit of both, and so that's going to, you know, cause a lot of people to be involved in that evolution, number one. And number two, understand it for purposes of advising, because One thing for sure, it's just going to be a whole different textbook for those areas of law tomorrow as opposed to today. And I just think, you know, there's going to be big changes in whether you have one systemic regulator, which is entirely possible, and another, either part of it or related to it, that's going to worry more about the consumer. And I don't think it's going to matter much how you label something, a security or a commodity or whatever. If the consumer is involved in a financial way, you may want to have rules that have a similar commonality to them. And I think if there was ever a time to look at all of these issues, now is that time. And then once that's decided, there'll just be whole new bodies of law, new rules coming out. So I think there's a sea change like we haven't seen in at least my lifetime.
Tom, let me wrap up with that. We got about 2 minutes left. I want to go back to the course you're teaching, because you've had a lot of different hats you've worn, working at agencies, being an outside counsel, being chief legal officer for a large financial institution. How do you weave those experiences and vantage points into this course that you're going to be teaching at Columbia to make sure that we have a better system going forward?
Well, I think the most important thing, I don't think I can... anyone can just teach the substance of what the law is or what have you. What I'm going to try to do in the course is I'm going to have the students play CEOs. The students going to play members of the press. Students will play members from academia, and students will also be secretaries of the Treasury. And I want them to talk to one another in their different roles and then switch the roles and to understand. I have a myriad, I mean just dozens and dozens and dozens of issues, and to try to get them to look at all of these real world issues through the eyes of the seat they're in and then switch seats so that they can understand that there's no right answer. And then they're going to help develop this regulatory system of the future with the knowledge of looking through real-world issues for a number of the classes. So I'm trying to get them to think and not to be myopic, and because often is where we sit is where we stand, and that could really not free us to do the things we're capable of doing.
Tom, before we wrap up, why don't you hit everybody with your email address so if they have questions, they know how to get in contact with you.
Okay, it's trusso@pattenboggs.com.
All right, trusso@pattenboggs.com. Tom, we would love to have you back. I think you, in the future, there's lots of great things that we can talk about here in the financial services world, and it is changing so fast, and the changes are so dramatic and impact us all. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking, so keep it here on the Voice America Business Network.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs
dogs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Good Thursday afternoon to everybody. It's nice and sunny here in Washington, D.C. We're hoping for a good weekend of weather and that spring finally takes hold. Well, lots to talk about. Just because politicians aren't in Washington doesn't mean that politics and government isn't taking place this week. But we want to start outside the world of elected officials and talk about yesterday's Tea Parties. By most media estimates, there were about 750 of these events nationwide, and it's in dispute. Democrats like to say that these were artificially created events, and the organizers of these events insist that they sprung up from a groundswell of popular grassroots support to protest not only the amount of taxes people are paying, but just the level of government intrusion that has taken over in the last 18 months as our financial situation as a nation has declined, and that is, in many opinions, accelerating under the democratically controlled Congress and the Obama White House. Turnout at these events was anywhere from, you know, a couple hundred people to several thousand people nationwide, and they certainly drew a significant amount of major media coverage. What was interesting was that very few politicians participated in these events. There was some well-documented instances of the RNC's national chairman, Michael Steele, being uninvited to the Chicago event. Very, very interesting there. And a lot of folks organizing their local events saying, we don't want our congressman here. We don't want a senator or a state representative here talking about government. You're part of the problem. You're not part of the solution. And, in fact, if you look at all the big names for the 2012 presidential nominations race, most of them stayed away. Your Sarah Palins, your Bobby Jindals, they didn't make an appearance, and Mitt Romney wasn't around. The people that did show up, I think Mark Sanford, the governor of South Carolina, who's made a reputation for himself as a contrarian, appeared at an event in his hometown of Columbia. I think Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor, now Fox News media personality, was at that same event. But by and large, the politicians were kept away, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this event. Was it a one-off? Was it over after yesterday? Or did these grassroots coalesce and form some sort of organization that that takes hold? Is this the MoveOn.org of the libertarian and conservative movement in Washington, in the United States, or was it just a one-time event? A lot of people are comparing it to the property tax revolt in the 60s and 70s in California that gave rise to the governorship of Ronald Reagan. It'll be interesting to see what truly comes out of this event today, or yesterday, excuse me. Now, the president, he's in South America, visiting the South American leaders at the Summit of the Americas. That's actually in Trinidad and Tobago this week after he visits Mexico. And I think the president's in need of a clear foreign policy win. With everything that's going on, it's easy to ignore that the president's had a couple of setbacks. He went to the United Nations and asked for a binding resolution on North Korea for their missile test of just a few days ago, And he basically got the cold shoulder. Russia and China refused to let the Security Council put any sort of binding resolution in place. And so that makes America look relatively weak. You know, we're allowing North Korea to develop technology that they may very well export to Iran or to a terrorist group that has the financing available to put that together with either some biological capabilities or, God forbid, some nuclear capabilities and launch that at a European city, at Israel, or at the west coast of the United States, perhaps from North Korea. And that's a very serious concern. So I think you're going to look to see President Obama try and get on the scoreboard this weekend when he's down at the Summit of the Americas and come up with something very clear. Unlike when he was at the G20 summit, where he was arguably dealing with some of his peers in a Russia, in a China, in the Western European democracy, some people that have some real heft on the international scale, here he's dealing clearly as the first among equals at the Summit of the Americas. And the people that he really has to push back against are people that are on the other side of the table from us. They aren't our bargaining partners. They're the Hugo Chavez's of Venezuela, and they are the Castro brothers of Cuba. And it'll be interesting to see what sort of victories he declares, what sort of agreements he gets on issues like the war on terror, the war on drugs, hiding money. You know, a lot of these entities, a lot of these countries are people that are players in the financial services world to the extent that they have offshore accounts. A lot of things are there. Their banking laws are different. They're not better or worse. They're just different than ours. And whether or not this request for financial regulation means that President Obama will be pushing for changes there. So I'll be looking to see what sort of wins the president racks up. I think the pirates case, you know, President Obama got a lot of credit for rescuing the captain of the Maersk ship, rightfully so. But I think he also gets some criticism for why we waited several days to negotiate with essentially a couple of guys holding an AK-47 in a lifeboat. You know, if we're going to take that kind of time and effort to negotiate with three guys in a lifeboat, imagine how difficult it's going to be for us to negotiate on other foreign policy issues where we're facing potential military action. I think that's a problem for this White House. And again, I think that's another reason that President Obama goes down to the Caribbean this weekend, looking for some clear policy wins, some things he can really trumpet as having accomplished outside of the United States. It's all good and well to have the adoring crowds, but you need to have some substantive accomplishments, and you need to show that America is going to be strong and America is going to do what's in its best interest time and again. Work with us if you can, other countries, but if you can't, we're going to do what's right for America. Now, busy week coming up next week in Congress. We get the House and the Senate back in, and they're going to go on about a five-week sprint to Memorial Day. And while they're on that sprint, they've got a lot of big issues to accomplish. The biggest of those is completing the fiscal year 2010 budget process, where they put together a budget blueprint. House and Senate have versions that I think the budget director called siblings of the president's vision, but not identical twins of that vision. And they're going to try and reconcile those differences this week and two coming up. I think the biggest issue is going to be whether or not they fast-track rules for health care reform to get through the Senate with just 51 votes, a pure majority, or whether or not they require health care reform to go through a process with a 60-vote majority, a supermajority. That will determine how quickly the president's vision for health care reform can get accomplished. You heard John Jonas earlier this hour talking about potentially it being done, at least the big picture stuff being done and in place by August, having a bill certainly get through the House by that time, possibly. And depending on how the budget rules shake out, it could be that the Senate has some time triggers to get things done that quickly as well. You're also going to see the Congress dip back into the foreign policy debate area. You've got a supplemental appropriations bill that's on tap for this coming month to look at funding our war needs in Afghanistan and our war needs in Iraq. That bill's going to be a little bit controversial. You certainly have elements inside the Democratic majority that want the president to accelerate his withdrawal from Iraq and aren't in favor of increasing our engagement levels in Afghanistan. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not they rear their heads here and have an influence on that final, the final shape of that bill. It's also going to be interesting to see, given how much has been spent by the federal government, if that spending bill gets limited to just Iraq and Afghanistan, or if it starts to attract various other goodies that didn't make it onto the stimulus bill, didn't make it onto the annual appropriations bills that were done by Congress earlier this spring, and just starts to Christmas tree up with a lot of other things. It'll be very interesting to watch that. The other big issue will be mortgage reform legislation. Looks like the Senate's going to try and get that done, and the big question will be whether or not there'll be a cram-down provision that allows bankruptcy judges to reset mortgages for troubled lenders. Now, we're going to be back next week. We've got a great show lined up. We're going to talk about the hot issues of the day in Congress, at the White House, on Wall Street, and on Main Street. We've been delighted to be with you the last few months. We know we've got a great crowd of folks, and our listenership continues to grow. We thank you for your questions, your emails, your phone calls. America Business Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.